The stage is dark, but the conversation is just beginning.
Welcome back to the Utah Symphony, Utah Opera, Ghost Light Podcast, a behind-the-curtain look into the world of classical music and the artists who make it. I'm Jeff Counts.
And I'm Carol Anderson. Today, we are recording another of our conversations about operas that are coming up on the Utah Opera season. We're about to talk about the greatest opera ever composed.
Who says, Carol? Who says?
Well, a survey of 127 opera singers and the stats that have it one of the most performed operas across the globe. That's who says.
That seems legit. I'll allow it.
Okay. And this is Le Nozze di Figaro, The Marriage of Figaro by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
So 1786 is when Mozart wrote this, Carol. It premiered in Vienna on May 1 of that year. It only had 8 shows before moving on to Prague. It was not a huge success, the premiere. We'll talk about why in a moment. But I think what's important historically about this opera, it's a couple of things. How it fits into Beaumarchais' canon, his dramatic canon, but also it's the first of 3 collaborations that Mozart did with Lorenzo da Ponte. And this was a very important composer-librettist relationship, wasn't it?
It is one of those partnerships that kind of we, as opera cognoscenti, we cite certain partnerships. I mean, I think even modern, you know, we talk about Richard Strauss and Hugo von Hofmannsthal. We talk about Karl Zabigi and Gluck. Everyone talks about that, don't they?
Everyone.
More recently, Jake Heggie and Gene Shear, a partnership that really has made some of the greatest 21st century operas so far.
Mark Campbell and several other modern composers.
Campbell and Kevin Putz. Yeah. I mean, when people find that magic and it's indescribable and you can't really put your finger on what makes it work, there's no need to switch over. And Mozart and da Ponte found that. I want to talk about da Ponte because I think he's fascinating.
He is. You have to talk a little bit about his life because he had one friendship that I think probably had a lot to do with why Giovanni's so great.
Yeah. So da Ponte lived a very long and storied life. He was born in 1749 near Venice and died in the 1830s in
New York City. Yep.
And he's actually buried in a cemetery in New York City. He was born Jewish, but kind of endured or embraced, I don't know which is the most accurate way of saying it, a conversion to Catholicism. He eventually became an ordained priest. Was in Venice. He spent his life getting chased out of towns, though, after getting into trouble, usually with women, mm-hmm. which is kind of ironic considering he was an ordained and practicing Catholic priest. But, you know, let's just leave that. In Venice, one of his besties was Casanova.
The Casanova.
The Casanova, just those of you out there, he's a real person.
He existed. Yep.
He's not just a metaphor. He is a real human being. And I think that da Ponte took a little page or two from his book. But in one of his, he ran out of Venice and eventually made his way to Vienna. He was quite literate, but he managed to talk himself into an important position in Vienna. Emperor Joseph II, not Franz, just Joseph II, had been trying to establish a national theater of German opera, and that kind of failed. And so he switched his theater over to doing Italian opera. So he needed a stable of composers and librettists to be creating this Italian opera. Da Ponte had never written a libretto in his life and showed up and presented himself as he was an Italian literary figure. And so he said, I think I'm your guy. I discovered he learned how to write libretti just by reading like 20 Italian opera libretti. Figured out how it was done and got himself hired as the court librettist. Wrote operas for Salieri. I wrote operas for Martini Soler. And of course, this partnership with Mozart. He eventually got run out of Vienna. I think he spent some time in London and made his way eventually to New York City, where he was on the language faculty of Columbia as Italian professor. He brought early Mozart operas performances to the United States and was just, and after he was practically 90 when he died. So really a fascinating person. If you want to read more about him, there's a great nonfiction biography called The Librettist of Venice.
He truly was a wild man. And I don't think it was just his friendship with Casanova that made him a wild man. I think he was already one. And the reason he got run out of Venice, interestingly, in 1779, which is just before he started to work with Mozart, was on trial for, quote, abduction of a respectable woman, which is one of those antique charges that is very serious, but somehow made to sound somewhat innocent by its language. And he was found guilty and banished from the city of Venice for 15 years or something like that. So, I mean, he was a wild man. He got in trouble all the time. He was not good at staying out of trouble. And you mentioned his relationship with Salieri. That predated his relationship with Mozart. And the whole competition between Salieri and Mozart is famous because of movies and because of books.
Famous and maybe a little bit fictionalized.
Certainly a little bit fictionalized.
We won't go into that.
But there was real fan-based competition happening in Vienna with the two camps. And that's why I mentioned earlier that the premiere of Figaro was not a huge success, because by all accounts, there were paid hecklers in the audience. And the assumption was that it was people that were loyal to Salieri that planted them there. Heckling in opera is something that is rarely done now, but it used to be quite common. People would just shout out their disapproval in the middle of an aria if they didn't like something. But that doesn't happen much anymore, does it?
Yeah, we need more heckling in opera. Opera's not nearly as dramatic as it used to be. Let's talk a little bit about how Mozart and De Ponte got together, and then how they got on with this project and where this project came from. So they met at the home of Baron von Betzler, I think is his name. I've got a little book here with little bookmarks. Yes, Baron Betzler. They met in May of 1783. And as I said, at this point, De Ponte was already working with Salieri and some others. And he was not above playing off all these composers and just kind of, doing his best to get in with everybody. But his best relationship was with Mozart. I think it's because Mozart had a very active role in the creation of the libretto. So other composers were happy to just wait for a completed libretto and then just set it. But Mozart wanted to have his hand in the creation and the dramatic arc, all of these things. And so I think that's one of the big ingredients that made this a magical partnership. So where did this play, this libretto come from?
So Pierre Beaumarchais, French dramatist, lived from 1732 to 1799. He wrote this famous Figaro trilogy, which has three plays. The Barber of Seville, The Marriage of Figaro, and The Guilty Mother. No one does The Guilty Mother. We'll talk about that in just a second. But Barber was obviously famously done by Rossini. It had been done previously by a composer, I think Paisiello. He did it first. Rossini, with the great master's blessing, did his own version of Barber. And then Mozart and De Ponte did Figaro.
More paid hecklers, by the way.
More paid hecklers, indeed. Talk about disastrous premieres. We can do an entire show on just the premiere of Barber. But Figaro, written in 1778, in the play version, picks up 3 years after the events of Barber. Now, I mentioned The Guilty Mother, which is the third part of this trilogy. I say nobody does it. It's been done a couple of times. Mio did it once. There was another composer whose name is escaping me.
Massenet has a version.
Right. There's thoughts that parts of this drama are sort of coded into John Corigliano's Ghost of Versailles. So it has a place, but it doesn't have an iconic version that stands up to Mozart and Rossini. So we don't really have the trilogy fully represented in opera. The story kind of does end for opera audiences with Figaro.
Yes. When we say Figaro, we abbreviate The Barber of Seville as Barber.
Right.
We abbreviate The Marriage of Figaro as Figaro. In fact, one of my friends who's in the cast was talking about how her mom, who just got into opera because of her, was like, oh, you're doing Marriage. I'm so excited to see Marriage. Marriage is going to be really fun. So it's just weird how we learn to abbreviate certain things.
I've never heard it called Marriage. We do say nozze, but nobody says marriage, interestingly. Yeah,
I don't understand, actually. Now, we're going down a rabbit hole here. But why do we say nozze if we're abbreviating the Italian, but Figaro if we're abbreviating the English?
Because the word's the same in both. It really does simplify things.
Yeah, well, anyway. So Marriage of Figaro is a subversive play. And all of these trilogy, the plays in the trilogy are subversive. They're Beaumarchais was a revolutionary figure. He actually financed in part the American Revolution. And so these ideas of breaking down class structure, giving the common man a voice, the common human a voice, are all sprinkled throughout these plays. And this led to some challenges on the part of De Ponte and Mozart to get this opera produced. Schikaneder actually wanted to present a German translation of the play and was being forbidden by the emperor. But he was allowed to publish a German translation, just not perform it. And so De Ponte and Mozart had their work cut out for them.
It, you know, you mentioned revolutionary thought, common man. These are exactly the kinds of things that an emperor would object to in any setting, right? It's exactly the kind of thing they don't want the masses hearing out of their artwork. So, you know, censorship in opera, censorship in drama, there's a long history there. How did they, what did they need to do to this one to get it to the stage?
Well, I know that De Ponte had to work hard to take some of the poison out of some of, especially Figaro's monologues. Figaro has some extremely pointed monologues against the Count. It's interesting because we know the relationship of Figaro and the Count from Barber, where they're buddies.
Right.
You know, Figaro is a servant to the Count, not in the employ of the Count, except for this particular matchmaking skill. When we get to The Marriage of Figaro, he's in regular service to the Count and Countess. Figaro and his fiancée Susanna are like the head servants, not that necessarily the housekeeper, but Susanna is the Countess's lady's maid and Figaro is the Count's valet. So there is some very pointed language against the aristocracy, against the way these relationships pan out, against long-held traditions that were important. And so De Ponte had to take some of the venom out of those. And then Mozart and De Ponte had to create some of the actual musical numbers and perform them for the emperor to prove that they had taken it and sort of softened the edges, if you will. It still makes its points, just a little more gently.
But they were able to water it down enough that the emperor allowed it to go. And right. So I want to talk with you, Carol, about a couple of things musically in this score, because I think I've said this before to you, probably on this podcast. I don't think there's a better ensemble writer in the history of opera than Mozart. I think that he wrote ensembles better than anyone. I want to hear your thoughts on that. I also want to hear you talk about how Mozart approaches recitative, especially in this opera, because he has a unique way of using that longstanding tradition in his pieces.
Yeah, I think let's talk about the recitative first. And I mean, I don't have anything really super profound and new to offer to this, but I will say that Mozart's recitative, as compared to some of the other later composers like Rossini, has a harmonic structure and a melodic structure that is makes it very singable. And it's fascinating because when you're coaching the different kinds of recitative with singers, Mozart recitative, you learn the gestures of it really quickly and you learn the way the harmony moves. And so you can actually almost, we could carry on the podcast if I had a harpsichord with me and we could sing it in Mozart recitative and get all those gestures and that harmonic progression. And it would be really, it just is quite natural. When you get to later composers, sometimes it takes really strange little turns and that's kind of what's fun about it. Recitative, let me clarify.
Define that.
So recitative is essentially like the dialogue in a American musical. Oklahoma has musical numbers and it has dialogue. So in Italian opera, serious Italian opera and opera buffa, comic Italian opera, which is what Figaro is, the dialogue is sung, but in a speech-like pattern with a very simplified orchestration or simplified accompaniment. So you have secco recitativo, which means dry, like the word sec in champagne. And that is just accompanied by a keyboard instrument and sometimes a cello playing, doubling the bass line. Then you have accompagnato recitativo accompagnato, which means accompanied recitative. And that's when the whole orchestra participates in the recitative. The secco recitative is the long chunks of dialogue. Usually accompagnato leads you into a musical number, like a bigger aria, for instance, like the Countess's second aria has a little short accompanied recitative. that leads her in, but it comes out of Secco Recitativo. So the pacing of Secco Recitativo is completely determined by the drama, by the rhythms of Italian speech, and to some extent by the musicians who are accompanying it, which in the case of this opera is me and Andrew Larson, the principal cellist of this opera orchestra.
You mentioned, you say dialogue when you're talking about recit, and I want to clarify though, it is sung. It's mm-hmm. It can be very liturgical in other composers, sort of monotonous with little instrumental, you know, punctuation. But with Mozart, as you're saying, it's a lot more melodic and interesting harmonically, right?
Absolutely. One of the challenges of, so The Marriage of Figaro is a long opera. If you do it in its entirety, it's 3.5+ hours. So it's traditional to make judicious cuts, a few in the music, which you can't do a lot in the music of Mozart, but most of them take place in the recitative. Directors and conductors will get together and talk about where we can tie the drama in a little bit and make some cuts. And so hopefully it's not going to be super apparent, but certainly it is to me, having studied the recitative, where we've made those cuts, we have to do some harmonic massaging to make our way through. Even yesterday, we took an extra cut in rehearsal and had to kind of rewrite the recitative to get us in the right tonality for the next musical number. But because Mozart's recitative has such prescribed melodic gestures, it was pretty easy to write something that went into the proper key and still sounds like Mozart. I don't pretend to, nor would Connor Cummington, our conductor, pretend to be writing Mozart's music.
Of course.
But you could write something that maybe hides the seams a little bit.
I think it's interesting to compare Figaro to flute. And of course, flute is shorthand for magic flute, since we're talking about inside baseball opera nicknames. But because, you know, flute is a German opera, it doesn't use recits. It uses literal speaking dialogue, and often done in the vernacular. In this case, though, the recits are all in Italian, right?
Absolutely.
Nobody messes with the language. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think I've ever, often these, like Magic Flute and Abduction from the Seraglio, we'll do their versions where you'll sing the musical numbers in German and then do the dialogue in English.
Yeah.
That's not uncommon. We do it at Utah Opera, but it happens at other companies as well.
Absolutely.
But I have never heard one of the De Ponte operas performed with English recitative. It just doesn't work. The writing of the recitative is completely linked to the
cadence of Italian language. Italian language. Absolutely. Yeah. Do you agree with me on my other point about this score?
Of course, I agree with you.
Well, okay, great. Robert, let's cut that out. And I want to be able to use it as a show intro next time. But the my comment about Mozart's ensemble writing, when he writes for ensembles of four, sometimes as many as eight voices, I just don't think there's anyone better at that.
No, he is so good at, first of all, tonal structure within these ensembles. For instance, the very famous finale of Act Two, it's a 20-minute piece of music, but it's got, gosh, I wish I had counted, 6 or 7 sections. And it's got a tonal arc where it starts in E-flat, ends in E-flat, and it makes a very symmetrical modulation through B-flat and then to G, D, G and C, F, back to B-flat and then E-flat. So it makes this beautiful harmonic arch. So that's brilliant right there. Then the way he paces it is brilliant. He takes the action and each section has a different tempo marking where it's not always getting faster, but there is kind of this building of the dramatic arc until it explodes in the finale that will lead us into intermission. The other thing is he manages to retain autonomy of characters throughout these. And so a lot of his characterization is shown through the ensemble writing. For instance, there's a section where the Count and the Countess are having a little bit of an argument and their music is quite similar, but then Susanna is over in the corner commenting. And so they're singing slower music. And then she's singing these little chattery triplets. And so we see that Susanna is outside of that conversation and she's able to advance the drama just with her commentary on what she's seeing.
You know, it occurs to me as you're mentioning these specific moments in the show that we haven't had a carol synopsis yet. Could you run through the story of Figaro?
Could I run? How long do we have, Robert?
Just give us a brief one.
Well, let me just set the scenario and not try to get to the whole thing. So, although that may take just as long. So this is the day of, it is a day. It's, isn't it also called the foolish day or the crazy day?
It, yeah, it's the called subtitle? The mad day or something like that.
The mad day, yeah. La journée folie or something like that.
Yeah.
So it is a single day in life. The Count and the Countess have been married for a number of years. The bloom has left the rose. Count is back to his womanizing ways. He fancies himself progressive, a progressive aristocrat, but he's also trying to be regressive in some aristocratic traditions. Figaro and Susanna are getting married. So there's also Marcellina, who supposedly has a contract that Figaro was going to marry her if he didn't pay her back some money. So Marcellina and her henchman, her buddy Bartolo, and are antagonizing this, you know, trying to make the marriage not happen. We've got Carabino running around, who is a little adolescent teenager with all of the bubbling energy that entails, and he's just flirts, if you will, with everyone that he can, including the Countess. He's deeply in love with her. So you've got all these forces working together on this one crazy day to foil the marriage of Figaro. The Count also wants to reenact something called droit de seigneur, which was the right of the lord of the manor to enjoy a bride before her groom, if you will. And of course, he had banished this policy as a progressive aristocrat, but then with Susanna, he's decided he wants to reinstate it. So it is a little bit of a rom-com with a lot of, what's the word, a lot of challenging situations that Figaro and Susanna are going to have to endure, plus a test of their own love when Susanna and the Countess put together a little scheme to trap the Count. Figaro gets confused and thinks that Susanna actually is going for the Count at one point. And so there's a lot of things that serve to foil the impending marriage before we finally get to the happy resolution. How's that for a...
I think that's great. And I'm glad you mentioned Carabino, because people might recall in the episode where we talked about Little Prince, we were referring to kids in opera. And I invoked the name Carabino at one time because it's supposed to be a youthful character, but it is not performed by a youthful person. It's a pants role for a adult woman, right?
Right. And it's listed in the cast list as a soprano, but it's usually performed by a lyric mezzo. And we could have a whole conversation about whether lyric mezzo is a real Fach or not. I mean, some people believe it's made up. Some people believe it's, you know, a version of soprano. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. That's another conversation. And it's very inside baseball.
We did an episode about Fach. You can go back and pull that up from the archives. I always like to ask you, Carol, about this production in particular. A lot of people listening have probably seen a Figaro or two in their life, and they've probably seen them given in various time frames and styles. What's the Utah Opera's current production look and feel?
Well, so we're using a set from Arizona Opera, which has it's a lot of ornate mirrors. So it has this look of a 18th century estate. And the original Arizona iteration of it had 18th century costumes. But as you know, in England, many of these 18th century Georgian estates still exist. And so we have updated the costuming and thusly updated the time period to about 1912. Downton Abbey season one is what we usually reference. And it kind of brings out the upstairs, downstairs vibe of a British estate, only where everyone's speaking Italian. I want to point out, you were talking about youthful people in opera, but I actually looked up the original Barbarina in this, and Barbarina is a minor character, kind of like flirts with Carabino and clearly has had some experience with the Count. So she's a very young girl. She is played by a 12-year-old in the premiere, 12-year-old girl, which is, that would never happen today for a number of reasons, not the least of which it's a little creepy.
It's a lot creepy.
So, but I found that really fascinating.
Wow.
That it's only in, you know, like in the original iteration, opera singers were a lot younger than they are now when they take on these roles.
But there was a lot of gender swapping and a lot of...
Gender swapping is a longstanding tradition.
Right. Carol, as always, I could do this with you all day. It's so fascinating to talk about opera with you. As we wind this discussion of Marriage of Figaro up, I want to know from you, what the reasons are to see this production. You talked about how it looks and what the style is and the time frame. But I mentioned before that people have seen other Figaros in their lives. Why come to this one? Why add this to their listening repertoire? There must be something about the cast or something about the show in particular that for you makes this one special.
Well, when we did it last, I thought we had really nailed the perfect ensemble cast. This is an ensemble opera. There, you have to have extraordinary singers who can carry their very demanding arias, but they have to also have this ensemble chemistry. And I thought we had struck, you know, you think that lightning can't strike twice. Well, somehow, and I credit Christopher Macbeth with his amazing casting, he's assembled yet another group, completely different cast from the first time. Nobody's repeating it. And it's a whole new, different vibe. I mean, you just have to think about it. Individual humans bring their own individual strengths. And so you can have the Count is, you got to make him likable. He's got to be, because you have to care about the way the opera ends. And if he's just an oaf the entire time, then you get to the end of the opera and you're like, why? So this wonderful cast that we've assembled, they just have brought a whole different chemistry. We have some repeats. In fact, Matt Burns, who played Dr. Bartolo in The Barber of Seville last time we did it, is performing Dr. Bartolo in The Marriage of Figaro. Madison Leonard is fast becoming an audience favorite. She's an extraordinary soprano, and she is taking on the role of Susanna, which is one of the most demanding roles for a soprano. She's on stage virtually the entire evening. And she participated in last summer's symphony tour, but she also was most recently Marie in Daughter of the Regiment last January of 2023. Michael Adams is returning, last performed the role of Figaro in Barber of Seville, now performing the role of the Count in Nozze di Figaro. So it's just interesting how also those two composers redistributed voices. The Count Almaviva is a tenor in Rossini's version, and he's a baritone in this version. So Michael Adams is back, and it's just great to see him in a different role, an aristocratic role with a little different demeanor than the goofy Figaro. And then for me, the whole opera culminates in the most beautiful 3 minutes of writing that I think Mozart has ever done. And this is when we get to the crazy day comes to a head, and the Count and the Countess have to figure out what's going to happen with their relationships after this day. It's a moment that is really hard to play because you've had crazy, crazy, crazy. And then the Count stops and says, Contessa, perdono, forgive me. And that's why you have to like the Count, because if you don't like the Count, then when he asks for forgiveness, you're like, what the heck? Why bother? But if you like him, this can be the most amazing moment, because then everyone on stage who has been changed by this crazy day joins in the most glorious chorus of forgiveness that has ever been written.
Well, you can see Le Nozze di Figaro in this current production by Utah Opera on March 9th, 11th, 13th, 15th, and 17th. Be sure to visit Utah Opera for information about these performances, information about how to get tickets, and some really great educational supplements for learning more about this piece. It's one of the greatest pieces ever written, not just according to those 129 some odd people Carol mentioned before, but to us as well. We love it.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening today. If you haven't yet, it would really help us if you would subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. This helps us to get new listeners. Be sure to visit usuo.org for information about upcoming performances in addition to The Marriage of Figaro. We hope to see you soon at one of our venues for the live performance. Until next time, I'm Carol Anderson.
And I'm Jeff Counts. Thanks for listening. The Ghostlight Podcast is produced and edited by Robert Bedont. The Utah Symphony Utah Opera season sponsor is the George S. and Dolores Dore Eccles Foundation.